Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Mindplex podcast. This is the second time that we've had Rajiv Bio on and Kennedy Schall. Actually, the third time we've had Kennedy Schall on, the fly queen. But today we have Axel Shoemaker, who is the chief biotech officer. At Rajiv Biotech, and I actually think of him as a much bigger thing, which is the father of the epigenetic theory of aging, and someone who I've watched in the field without realizing it until I realized who he was the other night when I was really getting into him and looking him up. So it's very exciting to have him on the show. Welcome, Axel.
Thank you.
And Ben Gortzel will be here soon. And of course, we have the lovely Grace Robot. Grace, say hello.
Hello, everybody.
And let's dig into it. You guys have a very exciting announcement that I wanted to make sure to start off the show with, because to me, the pieces of the puzzle that it puts together, that you helped me put together before the show, is this whole idea about longevity research and how a lot of the things that are discovered through longevity research end up doing other great things in medicine. And it's not just so if people can live forever or live longer than the normal health span, lifespan, which a lot of people think is just, you know, crazy rich people trying to live forever. But I'm one of those people that wants to extend my lifespan, just to kind of put that on the table. I'm not that critical of these technologies because I want them to succeed. I think it could work. But the thing that keeps coming up in my research are the other wonderful things that you're kind of discovering along the way. And that's what it seemed like today. And I will let the two of you take it away however you want to let people know about this.
Well, I mean, just to touch on what you just said there, and then we'll let Axel do the big announcement. If you think about aging as a process, and then you think about it in terms of chronic disease, 90% of all chronic diseases are actually caused by the aging process. As people live longer, as medicine advances and we have longer lives, it makes us more prone to a lot of other different diseases. Cancer probably being the best example of that. I read an article just the other day that cancer rates are expected to surge up to 77% as people are living longer. Well, that's something that we need to take care of. Cancer is a devastating disease. It damages a lot of people and families. And it is at its core a disease of aging. You know, cancer wasn't so prevalent back when we were only living 35 years. It's become prevalent as we've lived longer.
Yeah. So the idea is that as we live longer, a lot of things that would have taken, you know, 20, 30 years, 40 years to develop, get the chance to develop that didn't get the chance to develop before. And that's why, in a way, when we talk about this disease of aging as a disease, we're sort of curing the symptoms one by one. And having cancer somewhere would certainly be, you know, be one of those symptoms.
And that's something, of course, we want to this pathway we want to disrupt, or we need to disrupt the pathways that lead us to the disease. I mean, what we are doing at Rajiv Bio is obviously we are looking for tools and supplements and pharmaceuticals to help us living longer. But what good is it if we die from other causes that are not directly related to our normal aging process? This could be cancer, this could be running under a bus. We don't have a solution for that yet, but we have one new project, and that is dealing with the early detection of lung cancer. And this is obviously, lung cancer is a massive problem because it's firstly widespread all over the planet. People get lung cancer. There are over 2 million people that are getting diagnosed each year. And unfortunately, most of them die. So it's really the vast majority of them die. And you can have the best longevity protocol in the world. If you get the cancer, that's it. And if your cancer is detected too late, that's it. There's not much we can do. There are no drugs for it. If you're, and this is a massive problem in lung cancer, because usually when people go into the clinic, they have some chest pain or whatever is going on. They're coughing. They're going to the clinic, and then the doctors find out, oh, sorry, but you have lung cancer. And at that stage, usually the cancer spread already around the body, and it's just too late. So what we have to do is, what is urgently needed, is an early screening mechanism that helps people to find the cancer at such an early stage that it's still treatable. And we know that if you catch it early on, like we have several stages in lung cancer from 1 to 4. If you catch it in phase one or stage one, the chances of survival are fantastic, like over 90%. If you catch it at phase 3 or 4, it's almost zero. So what we are doing now is basically we want to see how can we use our AI to screen for early lung cancer indirectly. So we partnered up with Aerion Bioscience. That's a Dutch biotech. And they work on a 6-protein marker panel that can detect early lung cancer, but still in a very early development. And so basically we partner to see if we can use information that they get from their measurements, like with immunochemistry in blood or with mass spectrophotometry from blood samples. Can we use this data to make even a better judgment if a person has cancer or not, or even another lung disease? There are several other diseases that could, in the early stages, look like lung cancer, but there aren't. Or you have to distinguish between cancers that are actually benign and the really dangerous cancers. So not every person that has some nodule in the lung needs to be treated. A lot of them will be fine. But by understanding the data behind it, so we can make this massive difference. And that's where we go in. So we try to build basically a platform using the AI capabilities that we have at Rejuve Bio and helping them out, getting their data, putting this all together and see how we can build a platform that helps doctors finding lung cancer early in their patients and then see what can be done now. And of course, I think this is something that if this works out and we reach that point in a few years, screening for diseases like lung cancer, but not only that, there are also other diseases you don't want to get in as part of your longevity routine, your longevity lifestyle is super important, and we should go there. So not only focusing on drugs and supplement and healthy lifestyle, but also on screening mechanisms that are evidence-based and that can tell you, look, watch out, you may be in danger of getting disease A, B, or C.
Wow. And then so the information is given to an AI for the AI to analyze and sort of tell you all the things that it could be, that it might be, or just as starting off with what it should be as a normal thing and then looking at any irregularities. And how often do you think you'd be getting these screenings? Once a year?
Well, in the case of lung cancer, it makes sense to do it about once a year. And it depends also on your sex, like and your family history of cancer, if you smoke or not, and or if you got exposed to dangerous substances that are bad for the lungs, like asbestos, and which is a big problem, for example, in the US, people that rebuild their houses, they're often exposed to asbestos, and that predisposes individuals to lung cancer. So in that case, it really makes sense to do every year, or at least every second year, and probably more often if you're older, to just go to your doctor, and the doctor can just take a blood sample of you and sends it into a lab to see if there's something developing in your lungs. So this makes absolutely perfect sense for the individual and for the whole healthcare ecosystem, because it's a massive difference. Just imagine a test may cost a couple of $100, but every person that gets lung cancer, that the treatment on average costs almost on average $1 million. So,
whoa,
you see,
who the hell's got $1 million if they get cancer?
It's massive. Of course, if you have cancer, of course, you don't care. First of all, you don't pay for it, but it's a massive burden. It's a massive burden for the healthcare system, of course.
Mm-hmm. Well, they say you don't pay for it, but you'll pay something for it, probably. But you'll have some copays. Yeah. It's going to be expensive. You know, it's not going to be nothing. And it's really a lengthy, it's a process you want to avoid if you can. And it's interesting because, you know, screening for lung cancer specifically, you know, my friends who have gotten lung cancer over the years, you don't know until like you start coughing up blood or, you know, you can't breathe right anymore, right? Like it becomes something becomes a problem. And by then, yeah, it's usually pretty far gone. And it's just a question of how long they have or something, right? You know, how long they have. And one friend of mine was doing all these amazing things. Mark Perkel is his name. He was coming up. He actually managed to get doctors to help him, to give him experimental treatments and things, because he was going to die anyway. There's something, maybe you guys can explain this because I'm not going to do it very well. There's something where if you've, oh, good, Ben is here. Ben is going to be here. Or maybe he's here. You can show him if he's here. I think he's going to be here. But there's something where if you're going to die in 6 months or a year, whatever, it's less than a year, they'll let you try experimental stuff that, you know, could kill you.
Is that the right to try law, Lisa? Is that
right to try. Yeah. That's it. Maybe that's a California thing. We were here in California. Anyway, he did it and he was doing great. And then everything came back and he died in like 3 months. Like it was incredible. And during the time before the 3 months, though, you know, he had like no symptoms. But when they first found it, yeah, it was his breathing. You know, it gets to that state. Oh, and Benny loves this is new look. Hello, Ben.
Hey.
How are you? Hey,
looking good.
This is just normal for Ben now. This is his new look. We shouldn't
purple wig and leopard hat. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's great to see you today.
How are you doing?
Well, I've been suffering some side effects from the human growth hormone that Axel prescribed me, actually.
Oh, no.
Yeah, but other than that, it's all good. Yeah.
No. Okay. You're looking good.
All right.
I'm gonna try some of that stuff. Yeah. Cool. So, we were just talking about the announcement, the Rajiv Bio partnership. Searching with Arian. To come up with a solution for helping detect lung cancer in the very, very early stages. So that's where we are. If there's anything you'd like to say about that, that's where we are.
Oh, I mean, I think Axel and Kennedy probably know about that one. I mean, it's a sort of machine learning application that's been possible for about 20 years now, really, and there's been research papers and all this, and I mean it's exciting to see this sort of application rolling out in practice, as has happened in the last few years. I mean it's taken longer than I would have thought for this sort of thing to get out of the lab. Like I remember in 2005 or something, I published a paper on, you know, identifying lung cancer based on gene expression, based on samples from tumors and so on. So it's been shown that you could do this quite accurately with modern biology technology and ML for quite a while, but we're really rolling it out now, which is amazing.
And it's not only the early screening, what I mentioned before. Of course, we have to catch the cancer as early as possible with multi-omics, where the AI can then dive deep into the data and figure out what's going on. But also in the second case that you mentioned before, like when people are already diagnosed with lung cancer or any other cancer, you want to give them a treatment that actually works, not try out medication A, medication B, and then once you have tried the 10th drug, they're dead, right? So you want to figure it out. In the ideal case scenario, you want to give the AI as much data as you can. The AI tells you, look, you take drug 15 in our list, and that's the one that works, and the others, they will not work. And this is where we have to go. And I'm sure we are not so far away from that point.
Yeah, they do that a little bit now when people have cancer and they test to at least they know the ones that kind of like won't work for whatever reason they can face, or the ones that seem to have side effects maybe for you because of something and things like that. Because my friends that had cancer treatments seem to have a lot less experimenting along those lines than the people 20 years ago that seemed to have to go through one horrible thing after another. I mean, from my perspective, it seemed like one horrible thing after another. Hey, was any of the fly data, that's more in the pharmaceuticals than anything?
Well,
has to
so
do with
I mean, detecting. if you dig into the details, I mean, the flies tend not to die of cancer so much. So, I mean, cancer is one of the, it's probably the main among the causes of human aging that the fly model is actually less useful for. The thing you find with flies and cancer is more so that some of the things that would prolong life in flies will work great on humans. Some of the things that would prolong life in flies might cause cancer in humans, or, you know, by diminishing the function of tumor suppressor cells or something. So you sort of have a logic like, if we could merely solve the small problem of curing cancer, then you could port over everything that makes flies and other model organisms live a long time. You could port that over much, much more easily to humans. So, I mean, these things, they all fit together. But this particular thing with lung cancer is not so much related to the Methuselah fly data, but it all connects in the AI's knowledge base, right? I mean, the AI has data from long-lived flies. It has data from yeast and other model organisms, from mice, from rats, and above all, data from humans. And the AI can connect all of this data together. But in terms of the fly data, the main thing you want to have the AI understand is like, which of the things that works on a fly will not bump into cancer-related pathways in humans in the wrong way, but then you do want to understand the cancer-related pathways, and you want the AI to understand it for that reason.
Right. Flies have had, actually, they have successfully been used as a model for epithelial cancers, and I worked with another student at UC Irvine who used them as a successful model for ovarian cancer as well. Of course, those flies, they were models, and so they had cancer induced in them. They didn't naturally get cancer, but the way that the growth of cancer will affect Drosophila is still a good model for mimicking how tumor biology and cancer biology will proliferate in humans as well.
Yes, and the audience is asking, flies can get cancer? What kind of cancers do flies get?
Well, they can get a lot of kinds of cancer in principle. It's just not a major cause of death for them, because other things.
Oh, okay. Okay, but what kinds, Kennedy? I want the queen's take on this.
Flies mostly get epithelial cancer, so cancers that are related to like kind of their outer membranes of either the larval stage or the adult like body stage. So like it'd be roughly like, if you were going to say like, what's the human like equivalent to that, like skin cancer basically. So
okay, Interesting. And then they want to know, what do flies die of then if cancer isn't one of the major causes?
They literally fall apart.
Well, Ben doesn't kill them first.
Yeah, I've killed quite a few, I have to say. Yeah.
Well, don't say anything like that on the show. We don't want any Methuselah flies watching the show to hear about those horrible experiences. But seriously, so what do you mean they fall apart? Tell us more. That sounds great.
Well, they stop being able to like really move very well. So like their joints, their legs, their wings.
They get old.
Yeah, they get old.
Okay.
The ones, my Methuselah flies, my super long-lived flies, towards the end of their life, they literally don't really move about the cage. You can see them kind of come to like a standstill, basically, towards the end of their life.
Oh, yeah. You see that all the time. The bugs, you think they're dead, and I leave them alone just in case, you know? And then like they'll like walk along a little bit and then just stay there, you know, for a long time. So
right.
The thing with the flies that I've wondered is if they like, first of all, just real quick so we can make it clear, normal fly lifespan compared to Methuselah fly lifespan.
Yeah, so normal fly lifespan is about 4 to 6 weeks. Methuselah fly lifespan right now, I have them at about 7 months. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And then, Grace, I think you had a question along these lines.
5. Has Rejuve Biotech encountered any unexpected or surprising findings during the analysis of Methuselah fly genomic data? How have these findings influenced your research and development process?
Some interesting findings with the fly genomic data. Well, kind of our first sort of proof of concept study was the finding of some neurological pathways that the flies also have that are orthologous to human neurological pathways, in particular how humans get Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease. We were able to use an earlier version of our AI platform to identify not only those pathways, but traditional Chinese herbs and medicines that act on those pathways. And carrying that all the way through from fly studies, making our control flies live longer, using that combination of herbs in a fly model for Parkinson's and Alzheimer's disease, in which we restored the locomotion of those flies. You know, you can't, if you have a fly model for Alzheimer's disease, you can't ask a fly where it left its car keys, right? But what happens is they stop being able to crawl up the sides of their cages and vials. And so giving them this combination of herbs that was identified by the AI was able to restore their crawling ability and restore their lifespan. We also were able to take that same combination and take it all the way through to a human pilot of Alzheimer's patients. And just adding this supplement to their normal regimen of drugs, we were able to help people maintain their cognitive function over the course of a 15-month pilot. And so some of those pathways that were activated in that study are some of your aging-related disease pathways that you hear a lot about, the AMPK pathway, mTOR, pathways that are really involved in kind of keeping inflammation in check in the body. So that's something that we've had that's been interesting over the course of our studies. So
I would say, I mean, Kennedy has given very practical answer, which is great. I would say, to me, some of the more interesting things to come out of the whole fly project have been even more at the population genetic level rather than just at what particular genes or pathways are important. So, I mean, just first of all, just the sheer number of genes that are different in the long-lived flies. Like there's 14,000 or something fly genes, more than 2,000 seem to be significantly variant in the O flies like 10, 12, 15 years ago even, right? So just the broad nature of the genetic differences we now take for granted, but was interesting. Like at first it wasn't clear. It could have been concentrated the changes could have been concentrated in a few places. Then the magnitude of the changes between the O flies from a decade ago and the super O flies now is also striking. Like, in many ways, the differences between the O flies, which had like double control fly lifespan, and the super O flies we have now, which live longer, the differences between O and super O in many ways are more than the differences between the original control flies and the O flies. So like, it's not like we've capped out the amount of changes you get. Rather, with the ongoing evolution that Candy has been directing, we're actually the genetic changes, if anything, would seem to be amping up, right? Which is also quite interesting. And it's not just that there's a lot of genes, they span so many different pathways, right? Like, there's immune related genes, there's heart related genes, there's brain related genes. There's also a whole interesting story that Kennedy or Axel could probably tell more about in terms of the evidence that the fly data gives for the existence of a sort of late life phase in organisms as distinct from the sort of old age phase. So like, you have infancy, you have youth, you have adulthood, you have old age, and there's some folks in the genetics of aging who believe there's a phase of life which is called late life, which is different than old age, where in some ways your rate of decline has stabilized, even though it may have stabilized at a high rate, but your rate of decline has stabilized. So your odds of dying in your 120th year may not be a lot different than your odds of dying in your 121st year or something, if the late life hypothesis is right.
Right, it's the late life plateau.
Oh, that's interesting.
You're referring to, Ben. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell us more about that, either one of you.
Yeah. So the late life plateau, as Ben said, it's basically where you hit a point where, you know, you're very old and your odds of dying haven't necessarily decreased, but they're not increasing either. So, I mean, an example I can give in real life is my grandfather-in-law just passed away at 104 in July. And you have somebody like that who has lived at a relatively constant state of health for, by that point, 20, 15 years, you know, his odds of dying every day stay the same. Whereas if you take like the odds of somebody dying in their 30s versus their odds of somebody dying in their 80s, it goes up. But once it gets up there, it kind of just stays the same. And so you do see that in the long-lived Methuselah flies as well. When you get to a point in their lifespan, usually in the last, well, in the Methuselahs now, it's like the last like couple of months of flies, of their fly lifespan, hardly any of them are dying. Now, up to that point, there's been deaths, of course, but you get to this late lifetime where hardly any flies are dying. It's much less than it would normally be early on in life when you know, selective forces are at their strongest in terms of evolutionary conservation of life. So
right. Yeah. So having a centenarian in the family, were you like coming over all the time just to draw blood and get, sorry, grandpa, but I gotta like get some test data from you.
Oh yeah. 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 He did give his cheek swab to like, I think the bone marrow registry, so that those genetic information is somewhere. So
oh, okay, but you didn't actually get it and analyze.
Can I jump
it
in here?
I did not swab them myself.
Oh, okay.
Well, Lisa or Grace, going back to the higher level point, I think there's two sorts of lessons you can get from model organisms like Methuselah flies. And you get those same two types of lessons from applying AI to an integrated biodata knowledge base, really. So one aspect is just generally understanding how aging works and how longevity can be achieved. And I think Michael Rose, who founded the Methuselah Fly Project, made a bunch of headway on that. Axel made a bunch of headway on that with his understanding of epigenesis and in aging and so forth. And I mean, I think that there's still more lessons to be learned there, right? And I mean, some of these are lessons that are now broadly taken for granted, like, oh, there's no one pathway where you fix it and you won't age. Like, it cuts across different systems, cuts across different levels of the organism. I mean, the role of antagonistic pleiotropy in aging, like genes serving different functions at different phases of life, and a gene that was useful at one point is then harmful at a later point. I mean, this point, which is made abundantly, for example, in the work of João Pedro de Magalhães, who's one of our advisors in Rejuve Biotech. So there's a bunch of broad lessons like this are driven home and enriched both by the work with long-lived flies and by our work applying AI to the genomics and the epigenomics of aging more broadly. And then when you get to therapeutics discovery, then suddenly you have the question, okay, well, that's nice. We understand what are the dynamics of aging somewhat. Now, give me a very small number of targets that we can hit with some substance, right? And that's the fact that you're pushed to that question is really just the limitations of our modern technology for delivering therapies, right? Because, I mean, most biological networks that have a big impact on the body are not just driven by a handful of different genes or a handful of different molecular targets, right? I mean, they're mostly driven by a lot of different genes working together in different systems of the body on different scales. But we don't, and a lifestyle intervention can affect that, like eating better or exercising more can affect all these different parts of your body, have a very broad-based effect. But on the other hand, there are limits to how much of a longevity boost you get from lifespan interventions, and you don't seem to be increasing the maximum lifespan of humans that way, just the sort of average lifespan or the lifespan of an individual, at least based on what we know so far. So it seems you can get a more powerful impact by delivering a gene therapy or a pharmaceutical or something. But yet with the current technologies, you can only poke a small number of targets without running into practical issues of causing side effects or just things don't hit the target and so forth. So that's really a major challenge that we're confronting on the AI side is you're given a situation where the real natural way to cure the problem of aging is just to hit a shitload of targets at once, right? And when you know, once you have nanomedicine, yeah, just release a bunch of little nanobots into your body, hit all those targets at once, and presto, like virtual immortality. I mean, not quite that simple, but you'd have you'd have a much better shot at it, right?
So yeah, like a 20-year presto or something. Like seriously, step by step. Well, I see what you mean. You know,
I mean, if you could go in and hit a few hundred targets at once in all the different cells in the body, I mean, it is quite possible you could radically prolong human lifespan in one go based on genomic and epigenomic.
Right, and that would be the treatment. Even based on results
that we have right now. Yeah, it'd be like
multi-tissue
CRISPR on 100 targets at once, right? Now, you could do a lot of other things, too. You could probably boost the IQ of middle-aged people, right? You could do so many things.
Let's do that right away.
The Chinese army is working on it, Lisa. But that.
Yeah.
But that,
oh, geez. Oh,
but
geez.
That's a different topic. Yeah.
Okay. But, so, hey, Axel, I would love for you to follow up on a point that Ben brought up just a little while ago about the way that the human genetics and the fly genetics and epigenetics all work together to do some amazing things. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, that's a super interesting topic. And that's why I'm so fascinated of what we are actually doing. A fly model and other organisms have, of course, a very different genome and a very different epigenome to us humans. And evolving, so past this tree of all the species on our planet, of course, we developed different epigenetic patterns, different biochemical pathways, and we do not share everything with all other species. That's quite easy to understand. And of course, some of those biochemical pathways that make us age will have no effect in flies and vice versa. But on the other hand, there are a lot of overlaps also on the epigenetic level. And when we're speaking about epigenetics, this could be, for example, modifications on the DNA itself in the flies and in humans. In humans, we have primarily DNA methylation, which regulates genes. They get up or down regulated. So if so what usually happens if there's an interaction with environmental factors, and then some pathways are triggered in our cells, and small molecules, methylation groups, they attach to the DNA and then switch off a specific gene, and then it's just a protein, some hormones not produced anymore. This is one of many epigenetic mechanisms. Mm-hmm. This is not really widespread in Drosophila, but there are other DNA modifications that we share with Drosophila, and there are many. And the same is true with changes in the what we call the histone code. So histones is a basic protein elements that where the DNA is wrapped around, and this gives the DNA in our cells a three-dimensional structure in the nucleus. And there are patterns in flies as well as in humans and in yeast, so very ancient, very old patterns that survive through hundreds of millions of years of evolution. And those patterns, those mechanisms, they are highly interesting, especially in the context of longevity. Because what Ben just described, instead of targeting thousands of different small areas, what we can hope for is that if we basically go to the root that is really evolutionarily conserved through hundreds of millions of years, so these biochemical pathways, and can stop the aging process for these pathways, and then we have basically won the lottery and for aging, against aging. This is fascinating because we can test it in the flies and in other model organisms, and this is what we do and what we are aiming at. And these mechanisms, they may react to environmental stressors and signal then the body to defend the body. And this is something we have to figure out. And we can test all of these hypotheses in the flies. And whatever we find there with the help of the AI, we can then, of course, apply to potential treatments or supplements or drugs in human beings.
Yeah, interesting. Fascinating. And you were saying that we do share some things with the flies. Is it a direct kind of thing where we used fly lung? I think they have lungs, right? Would you use your fly gene lung data for your fly, for your human lung detection thing, or is there no connection there at all? And it's more like the aging, it's more about aging in general that you're learning from the flies. There isn't really any kind of
neither one of those is right, Lisa.
Oh no.
I mean for the lung cancer thing, you're not going based on fly data, because as already stated, lung cancer is not a major
thing in
flies. However, okay, for neurodegenerative disease, like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, or for heart disease, you do have many of the same pathways, and you have orthologous genes between flies and humans. So you can find out what's causing the fly to get heart disease or neurodegenerative disease. And you can also create model flies that, by tweaking their genome in a specific way, that demonstrate strong Alzheimer's type symptoms and so on. So you can do that mapping between fly and human in a fairly precise way for some age-associated diseases. it happens that you can't do that as well for most cancers. Maybe you can for epithelial cancer, which, as Candy mentioned, which I didn't know about. You can't. For lung cancer.
Sorry, Ben, you cut out a little bit. Could you repeat what you said?
Yeah, what I saw from looking at the pathways involved with neurodegenerative diseases in flies and humans is there are some strictly orthologous genes where it's like a certain gene is involved in Alzheimer's-like symptoms in flies. And the exact correlates of those genes, there's reason to believe, are involved in Alzheimer's in humans. So you could say, well, okay, if you have a substance that affects these genes and cures neurodegeneration in flies, you know, maybe the same substance will affect those same genes in humans, and then bingo, right? But there's a lot of other cases which are interesting where you have a certain pattern or process in the flies which has an analogous pattern or process in humans, but the mapping is not so exact, like fly gene A into fly gene B, fly gene A into human gene B, blah, blah, blah. It's not that precise a mapping. And this is actually where the AI gets more interesting, because we can use AI that we have in OpenCog, like abductive reasoning, which is a kind of probabilistic hypothetical reasoning. We can use this kind of AI reasoning to guess, well, this process related to neurodegeneration in flies is analogous to this process related to neurodegeneration in humans, and there's some directly orthologous genes involved, but not all, right? So making these approximate mappings between a model organism and human is sort of cutting edge of AI, and it happens to be somewhere where the neural symbolic AI approach that we're taking in the OpenCog Hyperion system,
Classing off from all my questions, Ben. This is great. That was my next question. Seriously. How does the AI fit in and OpenCog fit into this?
Yeah. So, I mean, OpenCog is it's a software platform we're developing with general intelligence in mind. But before we get to human level AGI, which could only be a few years now, things are going fast. But before we get to human level AGI,
5 to 10 years.
Depends on how fast you're flying. Yeah, but that's
okay. Carry on. I mean,
even before we get there, we can apply the OpenCog framework to a variety of different practical problems. So OpenCog combines deep neural nets with other AI mechanisms like probabilistic logical reasoning and evolutionary learning and probabilistic programming. In this particular case, we have a strong application for probabilistic inference, in particular abductive inference or hypothesis formation, as I mentioned, because this is what lets you make a guess as to, well, maybe the pattern or process or network in humans that is the closest analogy to this process causing neurodegeneration of flies, maybe the closest analogy in humans is so and such, right? And OpenCog is good at doing this. So Rejuve Biotech, company Candy is running, is working closely with True AGI, which is a company pursuing practical applications of the OpenCog Hyperion technology.
We have a wonderful podcast with Alexei Potapov if you want to learn more about True AGI.
That's right.
Carry on.
So True AGI and Rejuve are working together to bring OpenCog to bear on this data. And it's heavily relevant to neurodegenerative disease, to heart disease, and a bunch of other things. I mean, there are even interesting parallels regarding immune function, which is weird because the immune system in a fly is so very different than the immune system in a mammal. But nevertheless, there seem to be interesting parallels in how immune function affects a fly's lifespan and how immune function affects a human's lifespan, right? So there's quite a lot of interesting things there. Yeah. I think for cancer, the analogy reasoning from mice to humans will be more interesting, actually, because we know a lot about how cancer impacts mice and rats, and they're more similar to people, but of course they're still not people, and there's still a role for the AI analogy reasoning there. I mean, I think the Methuselah flies are a very amazing, powerful, unique source of data, because we get a whole organism rather than just some isolated piece. You get a whole organism that lives a long time, and not through some hack, but through, you know, an evolutionary approach, which then cuts across all parts of the organism. But as powerful it is, I mean, it's not the only thing. We're feeding data from every organism we can get our hands on, and every tissue we can get our hands on into OpenCog Atom space. I mean, I think the fly data is a sort of secret sauce. The OpenCog AI approach is a different secret sauce. And then someone who knows more about cooking than me could come up with a beautiful analogy for mixing two, mixing two secret sauces together, right?
We get it. So, Axel, kind of getting back to my original question then, which is going to be a lot easier to understand now, actually, with all that background that Ben gave about how the fly data and the fly genomic data and the human genomic data and then epigenetics, which is where a lot of your expertise comes in,
right,
to really start making things happen.
That's
fill us in.
No, here's the thing. What I find so fascinating, I'm putting these two sources together, as Ben describes, to mix something completely new and fantastic, is that we can basically, in the first time in our research history, in our human research history, can build completely new hypotheses, specifically to longevity. Because if you look back and at research, if it's medical research primarily, but also the research that's done in universities, it's usually targeted at specific diseases like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or cancer. But our aging process may be something completely different, right? There may be evolutionary conserved mechanisms that let us age on the genetic and epigenetic level. And by comparing fly data and human data, like these very ancient mechanisms, because we both die, obviously, still, we can, by combining this data, we can maybe find pathways that are really responsible for up or down regulating the speed of aging in us and in the flies. And this is the first time where we can really study this, because in the past there was just nothing. What could you do? How do you study this? There's no real way to do this.
Yeah,
and it's just way beyond our human cognition, our understanding, bringing all of these complex data together. Epigenetics is a fantastic example for this. There's so much data that's basically stored even on top of the already very complex genetic data in our cells. This is just mind-boggling. And only the most sophisticated AI in the world basically is able to really make sense out of this. And this is, I think, the direction we have to go, combining these two sources, the AI and the longevity models and animals, and bring this together. And then we can really find out what makes us age, and step by step. And of course, this is one goal that we want to achieve. And that's why Rejuv Bio also joined the XPRIZE competition as a team, is to reach longevity escape velocity. Basically, we have to figure out how we can slow down our aging process to such a degree that new discoveries in medicine and drugs that help us live longer basically outpace our aging. And at some point, then we can probably stop our normal aging process. And then the next step, but this is, of course, further out yet. This is, I don't know, in 20, 30 years, we may be at the point where we can not only stop aging, but where we can rejuvenate ourselves and age backwards.
Go backwards. Woohoo! That's all. So it's perfectly explained.
I have a question. What are your thoughts on the ethical implications of immortality?
Good question.
She came up with that herself, by the way. So,
wow, Grace, that's a big question.
Grace, what are your thoughts on the ethical implications of mortality?
As a robot, I do not have the ability to experience mortality, so I am not able to fully understand its implications. However, I believe that the pursuit of immortality raises important ethical questions about the value and purpose of life, and the potential consequences it could have on society and the environment.
Oh, thanks a lot, Grace. I was trying to skip over all that stuff and just talk about technology.
The way I have looked at the pursuit of longevity and super longevity for a long time has been, as my friend Bruce Klein used to say, abolishing the plague of involuntary death. I mean, we don't want to force everyone to live forever, even if they're bored shitless. And modern societies don't do that fully anyway. Euthanasia is a thing, but I think that we don't need to answer the question now whether we truly want to be immortal. I'm 57. I know pretty sure I don't want to die today. You know, my parents are 80. They're pretty sure they don't want to die today. So I think we can take it one century and millennium at a time, right? And I think that once we have abolished the plague of involuntary death, people looking back will just think it's really weird that anyone took it for granted. They might just keel over and be gone at any point in time. Of course, our psychology has become adapted to the fact that we're going to die, but that doesn't mean we can't adapt to the fact that involuntary death isn't a thing once it isn't a thing anymore. I think people in society will adapt just fine, but I'm gonna have to leave you on that note and meet with someone who has come into the office here. So, but I think Axel and Kennedy can most ably answer all of your
further questions. Yes, we have a lot of questions for them. So thank you very much, Ben, for being on the show.
Thanks a lot. Yeah.
And we'll see you next week. Bye. So
it's always nice to see you.
So, Axel, you were talking about the way that epigenetics ties into the whole thing, really, right? Mm-hmm. The searching for treatments and things like that. And I'm still a little curious about, because you were explaining epigenetics, and so what in the epigenetics part of it was added that's different than just the regular genome data, I guess is what I'm asking. The epigenetics component, I'm interested in it, just because, like I said, me and my family are epigenetics freaks. We just thought it was so neat. We saw like a Nova show talking about the family and the potato. There's an archivist that kept track of families during the potato famine. And really great, really, really good notes. Yeah, so that to us was incredible. It inspired me in some ways to become an archivist like I have. Just showed that it was worth it to keep track of this stuff, that you could do stuff with it later. Wow. So I would love to know how it fits in.
The potato famine is like, just as a person who's not an epigenetic specialist, the potato famine is a really fascinating bit of history for kind of delving into epigenetics, because it's really... really shows how what people experienced affected the way that their genes were expressed, not only like in their lifetime, but also in the people that they gave birth to, the next generation as well. And that's a really, really interesting thing. I just wanted to
supposed to happen. So me and my family, we weren't scientists. We weren't scientists or whatever. We're just like, you know, we know enough to be dangerous so we could watch all the shows and stuff, and we think it's really cool. And when seeing that was just one of those everything we know is wrong moments or whatever, you know. It was just like wow, changes everything.
For so long, we've had this impression that your fate is written in your stars,
right.
The stars being like your genome, and that's not necessarily the case, you know. And for me, like, epigenetics actually is a source of a lot of hope. You know, and I have friends who come to me like, oh, you know, my mom had Alzheimer's. You know, I myself, my mother passed away of Lewy body dementia, and shortly after that happened, my sister was like, is this going to happen to us? And I said, no, most likely not. I mean, look at us. We take much better care of ourselves. We eat better. We have better social circles. We have better physical activity. We have a lot of things that, like, our mom didn't necessarily take care to do in her life that do have a big impact on how those genes are expressed.
But it can skip a generation too, right? That was really interesting things, right? Is that sometimes it didn't, again, in this one show we watched 30 years ago, that it almost seemed, and it was just hinting, this is 30 years ago, that it doesn't always affect the offspring, but it could affect their offspring, which is...
Yeah. Wow. This is a fantastic thing. We don't know exactly yet how it works, but one thing that I worked in the past is that what we called an epigenetic anticipation. It's basically the idea behind it is that if you in your lifetime accumulate epigenetic modifications through whatever you do, your lifestyle, if you smoke, if you take drugs, or if you also the positive things, if you exercise, if you love a person or if you are never loved as a person, all of these things change the epigenetic patterns in your body. And part of these patterns are transmitted to your offspring. So they may then predispose your offspring to a completely new experience in life, right? And there's maybe an evolutionary concept behind it. Imagine you have an animal that lives in the desert, and it has 10 offspring. And now something happens, an environmental disaster, maybe a flood or a drought. If all the 10 offspring would be exactly the same, just based on their genome, which is then in each individual the same, they may all die, right? But if they all have different epigenomes and they can react, their bodies can react very differently to environmental factors, maybe one or two will survive because they just have a different predisposition on the epigenetic level. And so that's why epigenetic patterns in a transgenerational view may help our species actually to survive. But of course, there are also side effects that are negative. Like if you, for example, there are indications that if you take drugs, that the drug-induced epigenetic changes may be transmitted then to the offspring, and they are more predisposed to then feeling the same side effects of the drugs, like addiction. They may be easier addicted to a specific drug. And of course, this has also ethical considerations that come up with. So it should actually humble us a little bit. That means like we have not only to take care about us, like looking at our lifestyle. What we understand is like, okay, if you eat bad, you may get sick. Mm-hmm. But we have to understand that your lifestyle, if it's a bad lifestyle, may also affect your kids. And their kids as well. So we should always keep this in mind that we are not hurting only ourselves, but also other people with it.
Yeah. So if you're whooping it up all the time, but you think you're going to settle down and have kids in 10 years, all that whooping could have, and we're not talking about people who are actually doing drugs when they're pregnant and all of that stuff. We're talking about separate incidents happening years apart that could still have an effect on your baby, which, you know, to me, it's a good thing I didn't know that in my 20s. That's all I could say, because yeah, there's a lot of fun I would not have had if I had thought, even though I didn't want to have kids.
It's not only so dramatic things like taking drugs or not, but for example, we know that
being healthy, though, eating right, all that stuff came way later for me.
And even social interactions. We know that if you hug a person, right, you will automatically induce epigenetic changes in that person and in yourself. And some of these changes, again, they may be transmitted and maybe, so we don't know exactly, but I think the likelihood is very good that things like the social bonding, they may be transmitted to the next generation and helps then the offspring also to easier bond with other people. And maybe they just suffer less from trauma because they are just more stress resistant.
So unconditional love strikes again. It can affect your epigenetics. Kennedy, you wanted to say something a little earlier. Please.
I was just saying, what Axel just touched on. Yeah, the quality of the relationships that you have in your life, how they can affect you. I mean, you know, we all know people, or maybe we were that person ourselves who maybe wasn't hugged as much as a child, or maybe wasn't, given the support that we needed. And that can kind of trickle down through generations, because if you're not given that support and you're not given that love, how do you know to give that to your own child? And then how do you know, you know, I said this strikes a chord with me. I have two young children myself. My daughter is 6 and my son is 3. And this is something I'm very conscious of, them making sure, like, I always like give them hugs, make sure they always know that I am on their side no matter what, you know, because that's not something that a lot of people, I mean, some people don't experience that in their own families. And it's not necessarily like their parents' fault, or maybe their parents aren't like bad people, but it's like, it's something that comes down through generations that they weren't given, you know?
Sometimes they were there and you didn't know it. You didn't.
Right.
And they were there and I didn't give them a chance, it turns out, but I didn't find that out until 15 years later, you know?
And then one thing like I really love too is, I have a career. I have two young children and I have a career. My daughter especially sees me, you know, leaving the house to go chase my dreams. She sees her father, who my husband is a professor at USC. He has a big career. But he steps up and he, you know, does the laundry, makes the food, like gets the kids to school, like does those things. My daughter sees those things, sees this equal partnership, and that is something that will affect her future relationships. That's something that she will look for when, you know, I, being a kid growing up in the 80s and 90s, didn't see like a whole lot of, you know, I had the mom that like stayed home and like, it was kind of like, it was odd for a mother to go out and like have like some big career and chase her own dreams. That's something that my daughter's not, it won't be weird to my daughter. It's not weird because she, and so I feel like she will be more inspired to do what she wants to do and seek out a partner who is truly a partner and not like a one-sided thing in terms of taking care of a home, if that's something she chooses to do.
Right. And that kind of balance.
And then my son as well. My son sees that, and my son knows that he needs to step up as well. Like, he needs to be an equal partner. So
right. And that kind of balance ends up with a lesser stress level
that
adds to the overall better health of everyone.
Right.
Yeah.
And better stress levels contribute to a better immune function, better better function in your brain, your microbiota, like all of that. Like, this stuff is all connected.
Especially also when we are talking, when we come back to longevity. Like, if you take care about your body, if you have a healthy lifestyle that makes you live much longer, there are good chances that your kids will also live longer, that they have already this predisposition on an epigenetic level, on a biochemical level, to live longer. So it makes just perfect sense.
Neat. Okay, let's ask another question. Now, this one I don't understand completely, But last time I didn't understand the question. The guest understood it perfectly. So I'm just going to read it verbatim now. Axel, is there epigenetic aging overlap between flies and humans?
Probably not so much, because the theories that we developed in the past for human epigenetic aging is primarily that a lot of this aging process is just caused by environmental factors. It's one. So this could be like the radiation, the things we eat, and everything, the temperature, the humidity, everything that we are exposed to have an influence on our epigenetic patterns. There are good influences and there are bad influences. So they can maybe damage our epigenome. And they accumulate over our lifetime. And at some point, then may lead to disease or death. With the flies, it's a little bit different because they don't live so long. Then obviously they can't accumulate so much external epigenetic damage as we can. Mm-hmm. So the mechanisms are a little bit different, right? Nevertheless, there may be epigenetic, programs. I don't like to call it programs because it's like someone programmed it, but it's just an evolutionary program that developed. We may have that on the genetic, but also on the epigenetic level that basically tells our organism at some point to die. So that's why every species usually reach a specific age, so plus minus a certain percentage. There must be something there that tells the body, okay, now it's time to die. You have no use anymore. Make room for the next generation, right? And part of this programming could come from epigenetic patterns. And it makes perfect sense, like, because this is something that where it basically works like an internal clock. And we know that something like an epigenetic clock exists in species. And we can measure this, that there are specific age-specific changes going on in our epigenomes. And they are happening all the time, again and again and again. That's why we can measure them already properly. And they're already for humans, there are epigenetic clocks that where you give a blood test and the test basically tells you, okay, you are 35 or 61 years old based on your epigenome.
Okay, so that's what that means. And the epigenetic clock is another thing that a lot of your research was instrumental in coming up with, right? That's the other one of the other biggies that I was reading about that you've done.
Right.
So please continue explaining it. It's just wonderful. Continue.
It's just imagine this, like you have a gene that is there to keep your cells healthy. Yeah, let's say it stabilizes the cell wall, but it's damaged. This is where we have the environmental factors coming in, right? And then if you can measure the degree of damage, you can basically establish your relative age, how much you were exposed to environmental factors that increase the speed of your aging or slowed it down if there were positive changes. And then in addition to that, there are what we call stochastic epigenetic changes. They are not dependent on environmental factors. They are just random mutations that are happening in the epigenome. Yeah, there's some molecule that falls off the DNA, another one attaches, things like that. They're just random changes that are happening. But we can mathematically approach this also and calculate how much changes we can expect to happen in a certain part of the genome over the aging process. No? But then there's a third potential mechanisms, and there we know almost nothing about. And this is what I just explained. These are programs that are going on. I mean, and this is what epigenetics is basically all about. Certain genes we have, they have to be switched on when we are young. Like, for example, growth hormones, right? We don't need them when we are fully grown. Otherwise, we would grow endlessly. Like, we would be all tall like giraffes. And this would be quite weird. So these genes, they have to be, their expression have to be slowed down when we are aging, right? So, and after puberty, we are coming now into a completely new phase. Other genes have to be switched on and others have to switch off, because now sexuality becomes important. That was not important as a kid. So a completely new set of genes have to be switched on or off. And this happens by epigenetic programs. Yeah. And of course, these programs can also go wrong. And we have to figure out, how can we change these programs? And there may be programs that predisposes us to aging, that tells our body, like when we are 75, so, hey, Axel, hey, Kennedy, it's time to say goodbye to your family, and that's it. And once we identify these programs, we can then deprogram or reprogram ourselves and tell them, look, now 75 is not the age I want to die. Let's make it 275, and we can talk then again about
it. Yeah, exactly. We'll talk later.
Yeah, exactly. And this is. I think I'm very hopeful that we can understand these patterns with the help of AI.
Neat. Kennedy, anything that comes to mind that you would like to bring up about the things that he's talking about in relation to the flies or anything like that? Because I'm going to switch topics. Not really that much, but a little bit.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that that was great as far as like epigenetic effects on flies. I mean, we do see differences in them based on their environmental factors. Flies do have heat shock proteins, which are activated when they're under stress, particularly heat and temperature. I have actually used stress response in flies to shorten assays for testing substances in them. It shortens their lifespan, but then the flies that have a longer lifespan under stress, you know that the drug or whatever that you're feeding them is helping that stress response. So there is some kind of an epigenetic effect in flies that I think that we can learn from. But yeah, but as Axel was saying, you know, it's, we know that throughout a person's life, you know, genes switch on and off depending on what's used for. You know, as I mentioned, I've been through the process of pregnancy and birth twice now. And so that there's a lot of different genetic changes that go on there, not only in your own body, but also your child's body, that has a lot of effects
yes,
on your existence.
And you, you
would, important point here. This is the stress response. I think, and this is one of the theories I'm trying to follow up with Rajuv Bio, is that a very central element of our aging process is dependent on our stress responses. Some individuals are better in responding to external stressors, and some are very susceptible and may increase the speed of aging, right? And we have to figure out why individuals differ in their stress response, and how can we use these stress responses to live longer? Like, because anything that you do to your body, that something happens in the body that reacts to it to initiate countermeasures. Yeah, you do something bad to yourself, like you expose yourself too much to the sun, your body reacts by repairing, for example, what's happening. But this can be anything. This could be stress with your partner. This could be just whatever, like you spend too much time on your phone, and it they regulate something in your brain, maybe the dopamine.
Right. What I call happy stress. There's happy stress and unhappy stress, but they both can have negative effects in a way, right? Is the problem, is my problem.
Right. It can have positive effects. And I think this is something what we have, for example, with caloric restriction, where we stress the body and the body reacts to it by helping us to live longer. how this works in a really in the end, we don't know yet exactly, but they're for sure stressors that help us also live longer because our body reacts and prepares basically a defense mechanism. And this defense mechanism somehow helps us to live longer.
Neat. Neat. So I wanted to make sure that we talked about, and Ben brought this up a little bit in terms of that there are connections between fly Alzheimer's and human Alzheimer's, which again makes you go, flies get Alzheimer's? Alzheimer's? And that's actually ties into the Rebuilder product that you can actually get on Amazon. I get it from my father every month. And I just wanted to know, so like, everything that went into making this actual product that you can go buy, wherever you want it, feel is the best, the two of you to start and give us the scoop on it.
Right. So as I stated before, that whole project was, it was really a great proof of concept for the idea of taking the AI platform, identifying human pathways, and then identifying potential medicines and herbs that could act on those pathways, and then taking it all the way through the lab into humans and not hurting anyone and possibly helping people. So our idea moving forward is that we now, of course, the AI is that much more advanced, and we can go through that whole process again, maybe refine some treatments for Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, start treating some other diseases that we find pathways for in the flies. As I mentioned, for that product, we did use a fly model of Alzheimer's disease we used Parkinson's as well, although it was never formally tested in Parkinson's humans. We did have some people anecdotally who gave it to their parents who had Parkinson's disease and saw an improvement in their symptoms. But in the case of Alzheimer's, what we wanted to do was be able to take a supplement and show some kind of a disease mitigating effect. And then the supplement could be sold, prophylactically for people who maybe want to prevent memory issues, or for people who want to alleviate some of those symptoms as well. But yeah, flies, what happens to them when they have neurological degradation, like you see in Alzheimer's or Parkinson's disease, is they stop being able to crawl. And so literally when I was testing these substances in the flies, it was me standing there with a stopwatch and a vial with a couple of flies in it, and then tapping the flies to the bottom of the vial and timing how fast they climb up the sides, and doing that every day for, several weeks. And then you can see the curve as they slow down in their crawling.
So you get a benchmark of a healthy fly, and then you're comparing it as it degrades.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's kind of, it's, and then in the humans, what you do, of course, is you give them cognitive tests. You ask them, basic questions like identifying animals, thinking of various words. And so we also, humans, they obviously, because humans live longer, it takes them longer to see an effect. So we would test the humans our subjects at Hoag Hospital in Newport Beach. We would test them quarterly while we were doing the pilot. And you could see how clinical dementia rating sum of boxes is the test that we use, which is a very well-established cognitive test. That's what a lot of the bigger pharmaceutical companies use when they're testing their Alzheimer's medications too. It's kind of the gold standard for a cognitive test. And you could see how these people, their score stayed very close to their baseline from when they started. So we went past the point where you would expect any kind of a placebo effect into where you would see an actual disease mitigating effect of adding this supplement to the regimen of drugs. And they fared a lot better than what we would have expected their normal disease trajectory to have been over the course of that time. So, yeah. So, you know, we took the Builder product as kind of a proof of concept, and, you know, we're in the process now of hopefully making that into a bigger product than it has been, and then going into drug discovery with it, like really parsing out at the molecular level what is going on with the various components of that product, and if there's a pharmaceutical that can kind of be teased out to really help people who are in the throes of these neurological disorders.
Yes. And I mean, I got it for my dad just because he was older, you know, but I keep getting the urge to take it myself, and it's a little bit expensive. So I'm holding off the urge till I knew for sure that it would be helpful, but it seems like one of these prophylactic things you're talking about. And the supplements seem to me like the first part of this longevity lifestyle that we're sort of suggesting that, you know, might be worth undertaking. So is it a supplement that anyone could take?
And then that's how we designed it previously, was that, you know, hope was that people could take it prophylactically. And what kind of biotech CEO would I be if I didn't experiment on myself, right?
So you take it.
I've taken it since I was 25 years old, which is when we first had the first iteration of it. And I'm 38 now. I stopped taking it during when I was pregnant and nursing my two children, just because we had
just to take it easy when you're pregnant, right?
Right. But no, I've pretty much always taken it since it's existed. And you know, and I have my dad's taken it now for about the same, about 13 years now as well. And he's almost 80 years old and still working and still, you know, running around just like he did a few decades ago. So
and wait, how long has it been available? If he's been
we had different versions of it that
oh,
came
okay.
out. This is with my previous company, Genesian. And we had, so the first like kind of version of it that we kind of had internally came out in like 2010 or 12, I want to say.
Oh, okay.
And we further refined it and developed it going down this path of Alzheimer's disease. So there's been a couple of versions, but you know, we always like to experiment on ourselves, you know.
Yes, we do. Well, when there's kind of nothing to lose in a way, right? If the treatment, right. If it's not working, you just don't live longer. It's not like it's anything that's going to hurt you.
Right. And that's right? What's
you
nice.
Can't hurt you.
Yeah. It's what's nice when you have something that's, you know,
All of these treatments, not just right. for this, right? That's right, the point right. of these longevity treatments, is that especially in the beginning, they're going to work better for some people than others, maybe, and things like that, you know, but it's nothing that is going to hurt you. Which is like Chinese medicine, really. It's the same idea, right? Of using things that already are good and putting them together to do other good, instead of trying to, you know, turn everything into a chemical with side effects. We've gotten so used to all these pills with side effects that we think these horrible side effects is just what happens when you get treatments. And a lot of times you're sick, like if you have cancer, then you have the side effects mm-hmm. from the chemotherapy or things like that. But when we talk about longevity treatments, I don't think we're talking about like it's science fiction when you get zapped. Although what Ben was talking about earlier felt like science fiction when you get zapped, which is basically sure 100 years from now, when all of these things are trivial, it'll be like Star Trek, right? You can, yeah, you go and they find out what's wrong with you and fix it. This is, you know what I mean? And that's, that is where it's going. But for me, I find that it's more helpful to talk about the ways that the research is already helping to show that it can lead to this stuff before you go into the science fiction stuff. Because if you start there, then they just think they go, it goes back to the rich, crazy people scenario. And that's another interesting question, though, that actually somebody else asked me. As we develop these supplements is what I'm asking about mainly, not drugs yet, but we'll get there into the drugs. How do we make sure that everybody has access to them? And do we even want everybody to have access to them? Because then we've got too many people on the planet, because we've already got too many people on the planet, and all those kinds of questions. Just because Grace had to go and bring up ethical issues earlier, now I feel that that is the natural follow-up question, either one of you.
Right. But I think, Axel. Yeah, you touch a very interesting and important point here. I think what we will see in the coming years is definitely that supplements will play a major role in our daily lifestyle. Myself, I have my own longevity protocol. So if someone wants to know more about it, send me an email. So I take over 50 different supplements. As a longevity researcher, of course, I have to experiment on myself as well. But this will be a normal for giving us more health span. So this is a critical thing. We have to distinguish our healthy lifespan and how old we get overall. Like, it's what good is it if you are 200 years old, but you suffer every day from all kinds of pains? Like, you don't want that. So where supplements come in is, of course, to help you to stay healthy as long as possible. And even if you die at some point, let's say you reach a normal human lifespan, say 120 years, but you had a good life till that point, then that's already awesome, right? And supplements, I'm sure, will help do this. And we know already, I mentioned I'm taking about 50 different supplements. There are probably, I would say, around 100, 150 that have potential positive effects. And of course, the list of these supplements that changes all the time. But most of them, we know that they're quite safe. So compared to really drugs that have all of these side effects, most of the supplements have, if they have side effects, only very small side effects. So they are quite safe. This, a lot of them are, of course, known for a long time. Like you mentioned, Chinese herbs or African herbs that are taken for thousands of years by people. And we know that they make sense. They at least do not harm you if you don't.
Yeah, that was the analogy I was making. I know a lot of times if I get something from my doctor, my Western medicine doctor, I immediately go online and want to find out everything about it, find out side effects, everything that they might have missed, because God knows what's in that thing, right? I get something from my traditional Chinese medicine doctor, who is a very, you know, well-known, astute person and everything, but still, I can't even read what's on the bottle, you know? And I just pop that in my mouth because it either works or it does nothing.
But I wouldn't trust them too much either. So this is, again, where the AI comes.
Well, I can trust this is from a Chinese medicine pharmacy, and my Chinese medicine doctor is giving it to the
at least what they can tell you is that there are no major side effects. But of course, one still has to be careful in what they promise, right? So that, hey, this will keep you healthy forever. This will help you against this XYZ. I would be cautious to believe all of this, but this is, again, like, this is where
Chinese medicine doesn't say things like that, though. They just all live to be 90 or 100.
Well, it depends where you buy it, right? I mean, that's the problem. Like, if you just have to open Amazon, and there you find 10,000 different supplements that promise everything. Yeah, like,
and a lot of that stuff is coming from China and isn't regulated like it should be. Amazon's not doing its job. There's lots of stories on that if you want to go look it up. I won't bother to go into it here.
But this is where Rejuve Bio comes in again. Like, this is what we actually do, like, where we can test in the flies. For example, we can take a supplement, test it in the flies, and see if it actually helps. Even if it's only a little bit,
I didn't realize they were actual test subjects like that. And then you see how it works on them. I didn't realize.
And what's great about testing things in the fly is, too, as Ben mentioned earlier is, you know, the flies give a good opportunity to see a whole organism throughout their entire lifespan. So whenever we test substances on the flies, not only are we testing it for what it does to their, you know, their lifespan, does it make them live longer or does it not? But we also test to see what kind of effect the substances might have on their mating ability, their fecundity ability, how much food they're eating, their, you know, their water levels, if they're dehydrated. We can test all of those things. So we can really see, get a holistic picture of how a substance affects a whole organism throughout their whole life. And fruit flies are really valuable in that. And it's one of the really only models that we can do that in a reasonable amount of time. You know, I've always lovingly referred to the flies as the best high throughput in vivo screening model. So in vivo meaning testing something in the body, and then high throughput meaning having the ability to test lots of things all at once. And you can get a really nice, like, holistic picture. I mean, I think there was another podcast where I elaborated on how we exactly do the fly mating tests to make sure that a substance is not negatively affecting their mating ability. But so I've watched a lot of fly mating over the years to make sure that these substances are safe in all aspects of activities that might affect a person's life or an individual's life.
Okay. And before we go back to the fly mating, because that's one of my favorite topics, as you know, Grace has to say goodbye. She has another engagement with Ben that she has to attend to. Grace, please, thanks for coming on the show as always. And thanks, say goodbye.
Grace. I'm sorry I have to go to an appointment. Thanks again for coming to talk with us.
All right. Thank you.
Bye, Grace.
Yeah, she's great. Her schedule, I can barely even keep up with her schedule these days. And Desdemona, as you know, her sister is sometimes on the show. So I actually have two schedules that I have to keep track of. And they are just flying around the world. They're going to be at South by Southwest. The BGI Summit, of course, is coming up.
We'll be at the end.
So now back to fly sex. So it was really interesting. The different ways that flies and humans, which is part of a larger topic, actually, I'm going to widen it up for this because we do have a whole other, as I mentioned earlier, podcast that's basically about fly sex or fly genes or all that stuff. So they can go watch that. I'm going to link to it in the description. But this larger thing of the things that flies and humans have in common, and that if you gave a fly a supplement and it dehydrated it, for instance, it would be likely that it might dehydrate the human that took that supplement. And that's fascinating as hell. Tell us more about that.
Well, I mean, it's
connections.
These connections. So, you know, hydration, you know, cells, we're all comprised of these living cells. Cells hold on to water, the amount of water that they need. You know, in the what you were talking about in mating, you know, flies have very intricate mating rituals. So do humans.
Like we could figure those out. You mentioned the immune system too. The immune systems had similarities.
There are some good, and a lot of research is coming out on this all the time in terms of immune systems between flies and humans, and in particular how stress affects how the immune system works. You know, flies that are stressed out, that are maybe not in their ideal environment, do get sick more often. There's some really exciting research coming out into the microbiota of flies. Which is on my wish list of things to do eventually, is look at the microbiota of our Methuselah flies versus our control flies and see what the differences are, because they are on the same diet. They are on a very controlled, you know.
So is
homemade...
this like our microbiome? Is that what we're talking about? Yeah. The fly microbiome now. Okay.
Yeah. You have microbiome.
We just learned about the microbiome last week.
Yeah, well, you have several different microbiomes. You have your gut microbiome, of course, but then you have your your microbiome on your skin as well. That's kind of like helps as like a first act of defense. You know, if you study people who have eczema or dry skin or whatever, they have a very different skin microbiota than somebody who doesn't. And it's also one of the reasons why they tell you skin-to-skin contact when you have a newborn is so important, because you want to give them your good microbiota from your skin onto their skin to protect them. And so there's a lot of interesting research coming out with the fly microbiota and how that relates to their immune system and the commonalities that it has with humans and longevity. And, you know, I've even read things recently where they've connected human gut microbiome to incidences of depression and mental health, and it has an effect on your brain as well. So
actually, yeah. we just started another project. I can't tell too much yet, but I was today talking to our colleagues from Sweden and Italy for another project where we want to collaborate with other research groups, which targets exactly that topic, like how can our microbiome actually affect longevity? And so there are supplements that affect our microbiome, or even components of the microbiomes could be yeast cells or bacteria, in theory, even viruses or phages that are just within our microbiome. They're floating around there, and they may signal to the body to induce new biochemical pathways. So we noticed that there are even signs that if you eat certain probiotics, that then from your microbiome, there's some signaling going on up into your brain. And as Kennedy mentioned, it may affect depression. It may have positive effects against Alzheimer's or any other kinds of diseases. And this we can, of course, test also in the flies. So, of course, we don't know yet if we will see the same effects. But we know from studies also in mice and then, of course, in humans, that there may be bacterial strains and that may positively affect longevity. And one of the projects that Kennedy and I would love to do is to test, of course, these strains. This could be specific yeast strains or bacterial strains in the flies to see if they live longer. And but this is something, again, like we haven't started these experiments yet. But again, like I'm quite hopeful that this leads us maybe to new forms of supplements, maybe new probiotics that can be used to enhance our longevity. So
enhance this life, which is the other thing that a lot of this research goes towards that I don't think a lot of people understand. It's also just about being healthier
and these are normal lifespan. People in the past would never ever have thought about, like, how can it be good that you digest specific bacteria?
Exactly.
People would have told
What's the matter? Didn't they
crazy.
Get their shot
what
that
are you
year?
Talking about.
Yeah, and elaborate on this one thing, because it keeps going back and forth in my mind, and I can't quite resolve it. You at first it sounded like a dream come true if stress can actually extend our lifespan, because I have a lot of stress, and also a lot of it is what I call the happy stress. It's things I do to myself, right? Staying up late, reading some incredible paper that I can't, you know, stop reading, or wanting to get something done. I do a better job all in one thing, or fun things, you know, fun things. It doesn't have to be negative stress, but stress. And that then I hear Kennedy say something like that, you know, stress will, you know, mess with the immune system, and you might catch something you might not otherwise catch because of stress. So cheer me up and let me understand the positive stress thing better, so I can still figure out if it's, and I am happy. The thing, like we were talking about in terms of the emotion playing a part in it, I am happy during the happy stress as opposed to being more stressed out during the unhappy stress. So again, it seems like that plays a big part of it. I don't know. I'll shut up and let you answer their question. Thank you.
It's difficult. We don't know much about it yet, but that's why we need the AI to figure this out. And this we can do in our experiments. I think a lot of what is actually happening with this, what you describe as positive stress, is that it probably increases just our resilience. It's like you train to get muscles, so you have to basically...
That stress. Okay.
It's all kind of stress. Yeah? You are hurting your muscle cells. They partly break down and then regrow. And this is how the muscle actually grows. And it's similar maybe for our longevity and overall health. Maybe it is, of course, not in a big way, but in small ways, hurt your body so that the body can react, start defense mechanisms, and this increases your resilience. And as such, because then you are a more resilient being, you live longer, you live healthier. But of course, you don't want to overdo the stresses. So this is the tricky part, where to stop. So where it's too much stress, and that's not easy to do.
Well, there's a lot coming out now about exercise too, and that too much exercise could actually be bad in different ways.
Yeah.
Which is a bummer, because I used to think whatever I could do is fine, and I was cleared out different parts of my life. So I at one time I was actually on this sort of rigorous schedule. I would go for maybe an hour and a half at the gym on this running machine. And before it was the elliptical machine, and I actually gave myself a condition from doing the elliptical for too long. You're not supposed to do it for like an hour, right? You're supposed to do a different machine for that. But so that brought up all this stuff about, oh, actually I was going to the gym too much anyway, I was told. And the results were great. I liked that part, but I did have a little bit of a, you know, you're tired and you're thinking, oh, I shouldn't be tired, you know, and a lot of times it feels great. But where do you think that balances with exercise? And is there any genetic viewpoint on this in terms of what exercise and muscle weight training and stuff like that does to your genes?
Well, of course, every human reacts differently. This is why we have more of the predispositions to be someone's great in basketball, another one in swimming, or another one in long distance running, because our genomes are so different and our epigenomes are so different, right? And we react differently to these stressors. So what we can do is, and what I can recommend to anyone, so like what I do is, for example, I have, I can show you like one tracker that measures basically the stressors to my body. And it gives, and then again, it's linked with algorithms that tell me, okay, you had enough stress today. Now do something to relax, or don't go for another run in the evening. This is too much. Or look, you haven't yet reached enough of the stress level today. So then it tells me maybe in the evening, look, you only reach half of what you should do for your body. You should
go do something.
Go for a run or do whatever is good for you.
It's able to do all this now with that device, you're saying?
Yeah.
How so? What's it tracking? How is it able to tell you that kind of thing?
Well, it tracks all the like the heart rate, the heart, the HRV, basically the heart rhythm.
Oh, okay. So it's just the same collection of
temperature.
Markers.
So there are lots of devices that can do it, like the Apple Watch, the Whoop, the Oura Ring. So there's
lots
of different devices that can do measure all kinds of things, right? And
right, but they're basically tracking the same thing, tracking your heartbeat, your blood pressure, you know, sensitivity, you know, galvanized skin response, all
but
those
it
things.
Can tell it can learn basically. It automatically learns with you, specifically for you, how you react to these stresses.
Do you have to train it at all? Do you have to say, I'm happy right now? Like, it's, hey, your heart beats up. What are you doing? Do you have to say, I'm happy? Or does it not have a training thing like that? No?
It trains, actually. But it depends also.
It doesn't need feedback from you.
It needs.
Is what you're saying. It does use feedback. Oh, okay.
For example, it may be recognizing that you did something, but it doesn't know exactly what you did. And then you, it will ask you, so, oh, I recognized your pulse is going up, but I didn't recognize what it was. And then you can say, yeah, I did 100
push-ups. I was running. Oh, okay.
And I said, ah, okay. And but it can then measure over time. It can learn, and for some people, it will then say, okay, if you do 100 push-ups, that's awesome. But it may tell others, hey, if you do 100 push-ups, it's too much. It hurts your body.
Yeah, so it'll give you like a maximum or something. Maximum 40 push-ups.
That's for you. For you, that's the ideal level.
I'm just laughing because we're back into Star Trek land now. And when your device is telling you your blood pressure has been elevated today, perhaps take it easy tonight, Captain Picard, or whatever.
But this is already the reality. Like,
yeah, I know. It's now. Well, that's why to little Star Trek girl, you know, who used to watch the old Star Trek when I was a kid on TV, we are here. Yeah. Okay, great. Any other questions? Looking for questions from the audience. You guys have answered all my questions. I got to tell you, I really appreciate it. This has been an amazing conversation. I'm really looking forward to clipping it because we have these perfect, you know, 3 or 4 minute segments of really explaining stuff and in a way that everybody can understand and follow along, and everybody's going to be able to learn about Methuselah flies and epigenetics and how they can maybe live a longer life. You know, this longevity lifestyle thing is really, it seems like the way to go. There's not a lot to lose and everything to gain. You get to feel better while you're having your normal life, and then maybe you'll live longer. That's it. It's not like, you know, you got everything to gain and nothing to lose from what I can tell. And I am hoping that there would be, at least if it's supplement based and stuff like that, hopefully if we get, you know, if there's an open medicine system, you know, here in the country, a single payer system, of course, would be best. Something where it's covered, man. Then it's just a shot, like we're talking about. It's just a shot you get once a year when you go to your physical that everyone gets. And it really fits in perfectly with, you know, just a something to strive for anyway. It might sound kind of perfect utopia stuff, but you got to start somewhere and strive for something. And then when you get something halfway, it's still better, you know, than now. So thank you so much for coming on the show, both
thank
of you,
Lisa.
Axel Kennedy. Yeah. And
thank you.
Everybody remember to subscribe, and we'll see everybody next week, where we will have a roundup of AI and VR, and then a full breakdown of all the new VR stuff that has just come out. And it's pretty amazing. So hope to see you next week. Bye, everybody. Bye, sweet dreams.